Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a devastating report by the UN on how Iraqi civilians are suffering staggering violence, with at least 18,800 civilians killed and 36,245 wounded between January 2014 and October 2015, along with 3.2 million people displaced internally over the same period. An Iraqi-American political analyst and blogger, Riyad Jarrah, who worked as the country director for Civic Worldwide, conducting the only door-to-door civilian casualty survey in Iraq, joins us to discuss the continuing suffering of the Iraqi people since the Bush-Cheney invasion and occupation in 2003, and the indifference and lack of responsibility the Bush administration and the neoconservatives, architects of the war, appear to have in even acknowledging the humanitarian catastrophe they have caused. Then we look into the Supreme Court's decision to address whether President Obama's unilateral action on immigration reform violates the Take Care Clause of the U.S. Constitution that the laws be faithfully executed. Wendy Young, the Executive Director of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, joins us. She served as Chief Counsel on Immigration Policy in the Senate Judiciary Committee on Immigration, Border Security, and Refugees, and we will discuss the court's move to take up the contentious issue of DAPA, the Deferred Action of Parents of Americans and Lawful Permanent Residents, while the court is not addressing the other Obama administration program, DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which has more than 600,000 children who have been granted deferred deportation status now facing deportation. Then finally, with the mayor of Flint, Michigan at the White House today and the Obama administration appointing a czar as the point person for Flint's toxic water crisis, we will speak with Benjamin Davis, a professor of digital journalism at California State University, Northridge, who has an article at the Huffington Post, Flint and Katrina, Poor People, Poor Treatment, and Water. We will discuss the shameful wake-up call exposing America's indifference to the poor and black that Katrina was, compared to the man-made disaster in Flint that was not caused by a natural disaster, but by the decisions of two men, Michigan's Governor Rick Snyder and the all-powerful emergency manager Snyder appointed. And joining us now is Riyad Jarrah, who serves as the American Friends Service Committee's Government Relations Manager at the Office of Public Policy and Advocacy in Washington. He has testified in numerous congressional hearings and briefings. He's also a frequent guest on national and international media outlets in both Arabic and English. And in 2003, he worked as the country director for Civic Worldwide, the only door-to-door civilian casualty survey in Iraq. Welcome to Background Briefing, Riyad Jarrah.
Thank you for having me.
And Riyad, since you did that survey back in 2003, have there been other surveys done since the one that was just released today by the United Nations outlining what the United Nations refer to as staggering violence in Iraq?
Yes, there has been a number of surveys since 2003. Most of them are either based on sampling. So a few academic papers took a sample of the Iraqis and projected the larger number of estimated casualties. Other surveys were based on media reports. So this is, for example, eye casualties or the Iraq body count. Those ones were based on cases that were reported in the media, which obviously don't reflect the full number. Usually the numbers that have been reported in the media add up to over 150,000 in the last decade or so. And the numbers that are the full estimated number surpass the 1 million mark. 1 million Iraqis who have been killed since 2003 because of excess violence. So there are a variety of surveys out there, and today's release of the United Nations survey adds or confirms other surveys that have been emphasizing the size of this human tragedy in Iraq.
And this report out today by the United Nations Assistant Mission for Iraq and the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights is based on interviews with the displaced and direct testimony from victims, survivors, and witnesses of rights abuses. So to that extent, it is probably more accurate, certainly, than those based upon media reports. But again, do you think that this country is sort of turning a blind eye? I know that there's never been anybody held accountable for the destruction of Iraq. Not that anybody felt good about Saddam Hussein being in charge of Iraq, but since he was toppled, there's been just endless agony and essentially a failed state. And now we have this latest report from the UN. A lot of it's based upon what's been happening since the self-declared Islamic State took over large sections of Iraq. But nevertheless, as an Iraqi American, do you feel that we're sort of turning a blind eye and not holding ourselves responsible?
It's even worse than that, because turning a blind eye might imply that we are not partners, active partners in the crimes that have been committed in Iraq. Actually, this week marks the 25th anniversary of the beginning of the war on Iraq. The U.S. started bombing Iraq on January 17th of 1991. And unfortunately, we have never stopped bombing and destroying Iraq until now. We went through different phases, different names of operations, but it is a continuous policy of military intervention that has destroyed the country. So the U.S. is still very involved in the death and destruction in Iraq, whether it is directly by dropping bombs from the sky or by funding and aiding and training Iraqi forces who have been committing war crimes and gross violations of human rights. The U.N. report shows that almost half of the people who were killed, according to the report count, were killed in Baghdad, and many of them were killed by the government forces and militias funded by the government. This week, for example, there were a series of war crimes. Some might amount to crimes against humanity that were committed in the town of Muqtadiyya in the northeast of Iraq. These are committed not by ISIS, not by some scary terrorist organization that we hear about on TV. These were committed by the U.S. allies in Iraq, by forces that have been allied and trained and funded and protected by the United States. So unfortunately, these crimes are not only crimes that we've been given a blind eye to. These are crimes that we are funding by our public money and by the U.S. Political and military machine.
And again, I'm speaking with Raed Shira, who serves as the American Friends Service Committee's Government Relations Manager at the Office of Public Policy and Advocacy in Washington, D.C. He has testified in numerous congressional hearings and briefings, and he's also a frequent guest on national and international media outlets in both Arabic and English. And in 2003, he worked as the country director for Civic Worldwide, doing the only door-to-door civilian casualty survey in Iraq at that point. So, Raed, you're there in Washington working with the Quaker lobby group, and have you ever tried, or any of your colleagues tried, to engage those people in the Bush administration, those people in Congress who supported the war, who voted for the war, and particularly the neoconservative architects of the war, to basically ask them, in the name of human decency, to at least acknowledge the suffering that the intervention in Iraq has caused.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, we have tried and failed to do that with the Bush administration and with other administrations. As I mentioned, unfortunately, the Obama administration is the fourth U.S. administration to carry out almost the same policies in Iraq. So the campaigns of bombardment and military intervention started in 1991 under the first Bush administration. They continued under the Clinton administration. I was in Baghdad when U.S. Rockets and bombs fell in my neighborhood under the Clinton administration. The same crippling military and economic sanctions on Iraq continued under the Clinton administration. And, of course, we know what happened during the second Bush administration. President Obama came with very clear promises to end the U.S. military intervention in Iraq. And he did, actually, in 2011. He fulfilled the promise by withdrawing the U.S. Military troops from Iraq. There were some considerations of limiting aid to the country. Unfortunately, now we're back to square one, because even with the Obama administration, we're dealing with the exact same policies that have destroyed Iraq in the last 25 years, policies of direct and indirect interventions in the country. We have thousands of U.S. troops in Iraq today. And we have daily bombardment by U.S. fighter jets. And we have billions of dollars that have been spent on arming and equipping and training Iraqi groups that honestly have been the worst when it comes to the record of human rights violations. They are as bad as ISIS when it comes to the level of the brutality and violations of human rights. So, yeah, we have tried and failed, unfortunately, to reach out to decision makers in the White House over the last 2.5 decades. But that doesn't mean that we will stop trying. And I know that many other people in Washington, D.C., and outside of Washington, D.C., are still calling on the Obama administration to do the right thing and end this war before President Obama's term is over.
So given that the presidential debates are on now and all you hear from the Republicans and even from Hillary Clinton is, and from Bernie Sanders, you know, we have to defeat ISIS. You know, you've got Ted Cruz talking about carpet bombing Iraq, etc. How, if you, when you say the Obama administration has to end the war, how do you end the war with the Islamic State, Daesh, basically saying they are the new caliphate? They're not going to give up.
Listen, ISIS is a problem, but it is the manifestation. It's a symptom of a larger problem of deterioration in Iraq and the region. Of lack of a strong national government, and it is a symptom of foreign interventions. Now, defeating ISIS or other violent groups in Iraq and Syria, whether they are funded by our tax dollars or not, will not happen through dropping more bombs from the sky. I don't think anyone would argue that getting rid of ISIS or the other sectarian militias in Iraq and Syria is a bad idea, but I would argue that we will not achieve that through dropping more bombs from the sky. Actually, the U.S. direct and indirect military interventions have been one of the reasons for why extremism and violence has been on the rise in Iraq for the last 15 years or so. So I don't think that ending the war would mean letting ISIS or other groups go free, but rather switching to the right way for defeating these groups, which will not happen through military means, but rather through political and economic means. I'll give you a very quick question, example, and I don't want to take a lot of time on this. But
you've only got a minute, yeah.
There are many strong proposals for defeating ISIS by peeling off support from groups that are around ISIS, opening the door for people to rejoin the political process and isolate ISIS and other smaller terrorist or extremist organizations, whatever you want to call them. And these proposals can work if they were taken seriously. Dropping more bombs on ISIS or anyone else will not make Iraq or Syria a better or safer place.
So you still believe that the Iraqi government can be put back together again? There is a government, and if you bring the Sunnis back into the mix and stop mistreating them, and give money to the Kurds and stop isolating them, that you can have a country again?
I mean, in 30 seconds, I believe that an Iraqi government can do this. Maybe it's not the Iraqi government that exists now.
Right.
But I'm pretty sure that there is, you know, some sort of Iraqi self-government that can heal the wounds of the country and work towards national unity. It's not easy because Iraq has been really destroyed and Iraq's national identity has been destroyed in the last 25 years. But I think the first step in the right direction would be shifting gears and stopping the U.S. and other interventions and trying to focus on more nonviolent political and economic tools.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Riyad Jarrah.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Riyad Jarrah, who serves as the American Friends Services Committee's Government Relations Manager at the Office for Public Policy and Advocacy in Washington, D.C. He has testified in numerous congressional hearings and briefings, and he's also a frequent guest on national and international media outlets in both Arabic and English. And in 2003, he worked as the country director of Civic Worldwide, the only door-to-door civilian casualty survey in Iraq up till that point. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the Supreme Court's decision to address whether President Obama's unilateral action on immigration reform violates the Take Care Clause of the U.S. Constitution.
Send someone away. Got my back covered. Said, how you been all led astray? Come, let's count. It's absurd. They lead you to the maze, but no one's asked them to.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Wendy Young, the Executive Director of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, the leading organization for the protection of unaccompanied children who enter the U.S. immigration system alone. Previously, she served as Chief Counsel on Immigration Policy in the Senate Judiciary Committee on Immigration, Border Security, and Refugees, and held immigration policy positions with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the Women's Refugee Commission, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, and the National Council of La Raza. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wendy Young.
Thank you, Ian.
And the president, of course, has been pretty much stymied by a federal court in Texas, and 24 other states have joined with Texas to block his efforts to implement the Deferred Action for Parents of Americans and Lawful Permanent Residents, known as DAPA, and this has left 4.3 million immigrants in a legal limbo. In other words, the parents of children born in the United States are the ones largely affected here. The ruling is apparently going to come down in the middle of the election, and already we've seen from the Republican presidential debates that they're all competing with each other. Who is tougher on excluding immigrants from this country, whether they be Muslims or from Central America? So what's your reading of the tea leaves here with the Supreme Court? I know it's an inexact science, but how do you think this might come down?
Sure. Well, certainly this was an extraordinary effort on the part of the president, and we're hopeful that the Supreme Court will rule in favor of providing some temporary status to those who have resided in the United States for many years and have great equities in terms of remaining in the U.S. And, you know, this is, on the other hand, kind of a sad comment on where we've reached in the United States in terms of discussions and dialogue and political debate around the immigration issue, that things have become so hostile and so emotional that we have to resort to the Supreme Court to find a path forward. And recently we've been quite concerned, for example, that the Obama administration, on the other hand, in contrast to what they're doing in the lawsuit, is moving forward and raiding the homes of Central Americans and deporting them back to very bad conditions of violence in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. You know, we really all need to, I think, take a collective deep breath, step back, and realize that immigration has always been the backbone of this country. It's one of our greatest strengths, and it's a history that we really shouldn't be backing off of.
Well, that makes it particularly peculiar that Marco Rubio, who's an immigrant, or comes from, his parents were immigrants, has shifted his stance so much on immigration. So what explains, do you think, though, the depth of the hostility, particularly when it comes to the idea that the children who've been born in the United States, that their parents should be taken from them, that we should, the government of the United States should be in the business of breaking up families? After all, you know, we hear a lot about family values from the Republicans.
I think that's exactly right, and first and foremost, we need to remember that these are individuals, and as you're saying, in many cases, these are children. These are not people that we need to fear. These are people that we should be welcoming, helping them to assimilate into the United States and, you know, become strong, contributing citizens of our country. That has always happened with waves of immigrants in the past, and there's no reason to expect that immigrants that are coming to our shores today are any different. So, you know, and it is baffling and it's disturbing to see members of Congress that used to be supportive of these issues backpedaling in response to, you know, what they perceive as a strong public opinion in opposition to immigration, when in fact I think the majority of Americans still believe in our history. They believe in the American dream. They believe that we're strong enough not only to absorb immigrants coming to our shores, but to recognize their strengths and capitalize on that.
So, again, I'm speaking with Wendy Young, who's the Executive Director of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, the leading organization for the protection of unaccompanied children who enter the U.S. immigration system alone. Previously, she served as Chief Counsel on Immigration Policy in the Senate Judiciary Committee on Immigration, Border Security, and Refugees, and held immigration policy positions with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the Women's Refugees Commission, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, and the National Council of La Raza. But it would seem to me, though, Wendy, that, you know, we're talking a lot about the presidential race on the Republican side, I think because it's unavoidable, surely. I mean, the fact that the leading candidate, Donald Trump, came out of the gate when he first announced he's running for president, saying the most outrageous charges that Mexicans were rapists, etc., and then more recently, of course, he called for the United States to shut the door on all Muslims coming into this country. And the fact of the matter is that he keeps rising in the polls. So it would seem to me that, you know, the U.S. has sort of turned to the dark side, if you will. So where is the countervailing message and energy going to come from to suggest that there are better angels of our nature here in the United States?
I think that we really need to recognize the statements of Donald Trump and others like him for what they are. It's an extremist perspective. It's a fringe perspective. It doesn't represent the perspective of the majority of Americans. And I think, you know, taking a position of moral authority, if you will, standing up for, the history that this country represents, recognizing the contributions of immigrants, is really the only way to go. I don't think that you can outright Donald Trump on this issue, meaning politically outright him, because, you know, he will just move further to the right. He has found some, for whatever reason, some strength in that position, and I think others, including the Obama administration, need to stand up for what's right, and that's exactly what they're doing in the case that's now before the Supreme Court.
But surely you could make the case that the Supreme Court itself is outriding itself in many occasions. It has moved to the right. I mean, over the years, we still can talk about the conservative majority, the 5-4 conservative majority, and refer to the other four as liberals. But frankly, I think a more accurate and historical political definition of the court would be that there's five fairly, or it's two or three really far right justices, couple of, you know, deeply conservative justices, and basically, you know, four centrists. If you can think about the liberals of bygone days, like William O. Douglas and Thurgood Marshall, I mean, I think, can you make the case that our Supreme Court has moved about as far to the right as you could go?
Well, certainly it has moved to the right, but we're deeply hopeful that the court will rule in favor of children and families in this case. And, you know, we have seen a few surprises coming out of the Supreme Court, so we hope that that trend will continue. And I do think, though, that you're underscoring that there has been a movement to the right on immigration issues, not only here in the United States, but if you watch what's happening in Europe, there as well. And certainly the recent decision by the administration to conduct home raids, you know, literally breaking down people's doors to go in and pick up Central American children and their families who, frankly, have followed the process. These are the folks that have appeared in immigration court seeking relief from deportation. Rounding them up and sending them back home is not a reflection of our better selves. So, you know, we're continuing to press that that we treat people fairly, that we provide them the kind of due process that this country is known for, that the administration stand up for recent arrivals in the same way that they've stood up for people who've been here for several years.
So what explains that schizophrenia on the part of the Obama administration? On the one hand, the president has, because of the gridlock on Congress and the hostility on Congress, and this is the same Congress, as you pointed out, that only a few years ago it was on the verge of passing a comprehensive immigration reform package. Mm-hmm. But obviously they've turned into a fairly hostile direction. But nevertheless, you know, the president has done what he can to try and work around their Congress. They're furious with him, and they talk about, you know, him usurping constitutional powers, etc. But on the other hand, this same president, he's the president, the head of the executive branch, so somebody is ordering these raids, aren't they?
Yes, and I think, unfortunately, the administration believes that the perception that the borders are out of control is more politically costly than the perception of deporting children and families. I also think that they've failed to understand from the start of the Central American crisis, which really dates back to 2011 but really imploded on them in 2014, they failed to recognize that this is fundamentally a refugee movement. It is not an immigration movement. What I mean by that is it's violence and human rights abuses in Central America that's driving families and children out of their homes across borders to try and reach the United States in search of safety. And we need to treat refugee populations very, very differently than we do others. That's not to say that, you know, everybody should be afforded due process, but I think there has to be special consideration that people actually have the right to seek asylum if they reach U.S. borders. And unfortunately, many of the people that are currently being picked up and deported did not have proper access to due process. They were not represented by counsel. Many of them were held in detention. Their cases were fast-tracked, literally being categorized at the same level as people who have committed crimes in the United States or suspected terrorists. So this is really kind of a sad chapter in the U.S. history of refugee protection.
But there is obviously, well, there may be some confusion on the part of our audience in terms of what exactly is being heard by the Supreme Court. And I take it it's the implementation of the Deferred Action for Parents of Americans and Unlawful Permanent Residents, DAPA. But much of what you've been addressing is DACA, right, which is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. So explain to us the difference between the two and the different fates that both of those programs seem to be facing.
Sure. Well, on a very basic level, the difference between the two populations are those that are hopefully going to receive DACA and DAPA protection have been residing in the United States for a number of years, 5 years or more. Those that are subject to the recent raids and deportations are Central Americans that are much more recent arrivals. They arrived after January 1st, 2014, so in the past couple of years. And they are being specifically targeted because they arrived as part of the surge that we all witnessed in the summer of 2014 when you saw roughly 68,000 unaccompanied children and many more families arriving in large numbers, again, to escape the violence in Central America.
So that's not a part of the president's initiative.
Correct. That's completely different. It's a little bit like the left hand and the right hand don't know what they're doing right now.
Right. And so, in effect, there is no legal protection. Or I know that that's your organization, KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, that are taking up the issue of trying to protect these unaccompanied children. So there's no initiative on the part of the administration to take an executive action to protect these children, as they have with the parents, with DAPA?
That's right. They would not benefit from the executive action if it's held to be a lawful effort on the part of the administration. These are people that have been placed in deportation proceedings after their arrival. Many of them have been through the court process, but again, their cases were fast-tracked, they were detained, they were unrepresented by counsel, so they really did not receive a fair hearing, and yet we're returning them back to danger in their home countries.
Well, it's worse than that, though, isn't it? They've been interviewed and they've been placed in, I imagine, in some kind of holding centers or in homes or whatever. But the point is that the federal government, who screened them and interviewed them, also has their addresses. And now they're handing those addresses over to ICE and they're kicking the doors down. That seems to be a little unfair.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And we're hearing numerous stories of kids who are so frightened. They're not showing up for school. They're not showing up for medical appointments. And I can tell you, even in our own legal services program, we have children who are canceling their intakes with us because their case intakes, because they're so afraid to go outside. They're afraid they're going to get picked up and returned home.
So given the politically charged nature of this issue in this election year, and the fact that it's being taken up by the Supreme Court, and what's your understanding of when there'll be a resolution or ruling?
I understand it could be in June of this year, which, of course, is right in the height of the political season. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens next.
So given, as we've mentioned, how much of an issue this has become in the Republican debates, and they're each sort of trying to accuse each other of having either supported amnesty or leaning towards amnesty, et cetera. I think the only one of the candidates that has shown compassion for immigrants has been the governor of Ohio, John Kasich. What's your sense of what's coming from the Democratic candidates, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton?
Well, certainly they have stood up in support of the lawsuit, and they've also stood up in support of those that are being picked up and detained and deported right now from Central America. So they've staked out very strong positions, and we hope that they will adhere to that and continue that kind of momentum. You know, we have to get through this election cycle. We have to get through 2016, and then hopefully in 2017 things will calm down and we can go back to a rational debate and discussion around these very, very complicated issues.
But I take it that as long as you have this constituency that Donald Trump's appealing to, and as he goes up in the polls, some people are suggesting that we simply don't know what kind of numbers we're dealing with here, and that Donald Trump may well get the Republican nomination, and he may even get elected president, because there's simply a lot of people that are flocking to his message that haven't voted before. They're, in effect, sort of coming out of the woodwork, if you will. So what's your sense then of, again, I know I've asked that question before about the better angels of our nature emerging, but is there any accurate polling on how, you said earlier that most Americans support the idea of immigration and have compassion for, particularly for these young children, who's either, if in the case of the Supreme Court case that's been taken up, face the prospect of their parents being deported. And on the other hand, the children that you deal with at KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, of course, have come here and now they're facing deportation.
Yeah, most polls show that most Americans are in favor of comprehensive immigration reform. They recognize that the immigration system as it's currently constructed is really dysfunctional and was designed for a different era. They also recognize that most people have been here for quite some time and have built up equities. And these are their neighbors' children, who really should not be, subject to deportation and removal from the United States. So I think most people take a pretty rational approach to these issues. I think, unfortunately, those who oppose immigration reform, who oppose, status for the undocumented, tend to be very heated about the discussion. So their voices tend to be very loud, so they tend to be heard. And I think that's dominating much of the political discussion right now. So again, that's why I'm saying I think we need to get through 2016 and really sit back and look at these issues with the kind of thoughtfulness that they require in order to find a solution and a path forward for all immigrants, whether they're coming here because they're fleeing violence in their home countries, such as we see in Central America, or because they've come here, they've established roots, and they're contributing members of our society.
Well, just in closing, Wendy Young, since you have worked with the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops on the issue of immigration, and that I can't remember how many members of the Supreme Court are Catholic, but it's a pretty, I think almost all of the conservatives are Catholics, right? And there's several on the so-called liberal side as well. How much influence do you think the position of the church has taken on this issue might affect the judgments of the justices?
Well, certainly, I think that the Pope was heard in his recent visit, and he provided a very strong ethical voice in support of immigrants and other newcomers to communities. And certainly, we count on the faith-based community of all stripes and all sects to come together and help us in this fight. And I think most of the faith-based community stand very, very strongly with us. So they're a very important voice in the debate.
Well, Wendy Young, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Wendy Young, who's Executive Director of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, the leading organization for the protection of unaccompanied children who enter the U.S. immigration system alone. Previously, she served as Chief Counsel on Immigration Policy in the Senate Judiciary Committee on Immigration, Border Security, and Refugees, and held immigration policy positions with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the Women's Refugee Commission, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, and the National Council of La Raza. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the comparison between Katrina, a natural disaster, and the man-made disaster in Flint, Michigan.
What's happened to the water? Our water's going bad. Oceans, rivers, lakes, and streams have all been touched by man. Poison floating out to sea now threatens life on land.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Benjamin Davis, a professor in digital journalism, broadcast presentation, and writing at California State University, Northridge. He has worked as a reporter for MSNBC.com, ABC News, CBS News, Fox News, and National Public Radio in Washington, D.C. He's the author of the e-book, The Digital Media Pyramid, and he has an article at the Huffington Post, Flint and Katrina, Poor People, Poor Treatment, and Water. Welcome to Background Briefing, Benjamin Davis.
Glad to be here.
And the mayor of Flint, Michigan, Karen Weaver, has met in the White House with President Obama's top advisor, Valerie Jarrett. She's also going to be meeting with the president today. And the White House have already essentially appointed a czar, a point person, for this toxic water crisis in Flint, Michigan. The Department of Health and Human Services designated Dr. Nicole Lurie. Your piece in the Huffington Post, Flint and Katrina, Poor People, Poor Treatment and Water, makes a connection between Katrina and the ongoing situation in Flint, in as much as it essentially the treatment of poor African-American people in the American underclass, if you will, is suddenly come to light as it did under Katrina. I guess the difference, though, Benjamin, is that Katrina was a natural disaster and Flint is a man-made disaster, largely caused, I think you can fairly say, by the governor of the state of Michigan, Rick Snyder.
Yeah, true. Disasters, nevertheless. And in each case, what I wanted the people to think about is the fact that we as Americans, sometimes we just kick back and say, hey, not my problem. And it can be the problem of African Americans or people who are in the lower income strata. And it's not my problem, not in my backyard. But what we're witnessing right now, we're finding that people of lower income are saying, not in my backyard either. But it's really that attitude that we can have as Americans sometimes, which is, you know what, they're poor. This is probably why they're poor. They're used to it. I'm okay. I have some things to do right now. I'll catch up with you later. And you can't live that way. You can't be a great nation that way. And certainly coming around the time of Dr. King's birth, an anniversary, and when we remember things about how we're supposed to be compassionate, you certainly need to think that way now, but throughout the year, forever, for years to come. And how we treat the least amongst us reflects more about us as a whole. And then Katrina, we flunked. I mean, it was Mother Nature. Right now with Flint, we flunked. And when I say we, we're talking to bureaucrats, we're talking to government officials, elected and appointed.
Well, specifically, though, the decision to switch Flint's water supply from its supply that it had been getting from the city of Detroit to the Flint River was taken by an emergency manager appointed by the governor of Michigan under an austerity move to rein in costs. And it was essentially a cost-cutting decision that made by one person who was only answerable to the governor. No local authorities, no local bureaucrats, nobody had any other input but the emergency manager.
Yeah, well, you know, that emergency manager, of course, wanted to satisfy his boss. The thing to remember about his boss, ultimately, his boss is a venture capitalist. I mean, that was his profession before becoming governor. And speaking as someone who's dealt with venture capitalists often, they look at the bottom line. They learn how to cut better than a surgeon does. And he certainly wanted to satisfy his boss, the venture capitalist. And I don't think it's always a great idea to put business people in places of government, especially high government, where you have to deal with transportation, human rights type of issues, potholes. In this case, Michigan appointed a venture capitalist to run the state. This is what you get.
Well, there is, though, in that state, a rural-urban divide. At the moment, the Republicans control the legislature and the state legislature and the governorship, but their votes come from rural Michigan and the urban centers like Detroit and Flint. Both of them have been essentially put under emergency management by Governor Snyder, first Detroit. Many analysts say that the bankruptcy of Detroit was completely unnecessary. It was just another punitive austerity measure. So there's a great deal of suspicion that this is also about partisan politics. Not only is the governor a venture capitalist, he's also a partisan Republican who basically, you know, doesn't have any time for people who vote Democrat.
Well, you know, it's there's this saying that's going around. Now, I'm not cool, I'm not hip, I'm not with it, but some of the young people on social media now are using this term woke. And if you relate that to the end of Spike Lee's movie, I think it was Do the Right Thing, where he said, wake up. Well, now the young people are going around saying woke. And part of being woke is saying, wait, we have to get the state legislatures back. We have to figure out how to counteract what the American Legislative Exchange Council has done throughout the U.S. in terms of capturing state legislatures. That's part of the issue there. Yeah, it's politics. Plain and simple, it's politics at the end of the day. It's not political to say that it is. You know, what's really political is to say, no, we are just doing what's good for the city of Detroit. But it's politics, plain and simple. Politics is to say that it's not politics. And I find a growing tide of young people, African-American, Caucasian, Hispanic, who are organizing, self-organizing on social media, and they're growing, and they see problems like Flint. They see problems like police brutality, and they self-organize, and they decide to attack the problem. And I think they've seen the issue with the state legislatures as well. That's where they have to put their focus. That's part of the biggest, that's the biggest problem you can see out there right now in terms of policies that affect people in lower income strata.
So, in effect, you're calling for a people's version of ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council. In other words, we need on the political left a version of ALEC. Is that what you're saying?
It's needed, but I'm also saying that if no formal group comes forth, it's happening. It's already happening. We are in the very early stages of a young generation feeling its oats, and they feel it through social media. And they will be monster in 10 years. They're actually doing a darn good job right now with Black Lives Matter and the other, you know, online social media outlets. But yeah, that's what's going to happen. It's needed now. But what I'm saying is that they aren't sleeping at the wheel anymore, young people. And it's convenient to say that. You know, it's a very optimistic thing to say. But I can tell you, working with them, they're doing it. It's not just a pipe dream.
And again, I'm speaking with Benjamin Davis, a professor of digital journalism, broadcast presentation and writing at California State University, Northridge. He's worked as a reporter for MSNBC.com, ABC News, CBS News, Fox News, and National Public Radio in Washington, D.C., and is the author of the e-book, The Digital Media Pyramid. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Flint and Katrina, Poor People, Poor Treatment, and Water. So the governor of Michigan, Rick Snyder, he sort of turned around and wants the federal government to declare what he's done a disaster, and he's called on FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, to step in. And FEMA, of course, have had to send a letter back to Governor Snyder denying his request, quoting the letter, because the water contamination does not meet the legal definition of a major disaster under federal law. The incident was not the result of a natural catastrophe, nor was it created by fire, flood, or explosion. Again, do you think that, you've got Bernie Sanders calling for Governor Snyder's resignation, and Hillary Clinton actually was the first person to step up and name names in regard to Snyder. And the very next day, he acted. Prior to that, he hadn't done a damn thing and hadn't even acknowledged the crisis. So what's your sense of actually, let me just read what Hillary Clinton said, which prompted Snyder to at least acknowledge the problem and then send in the National Guard with bottled water and water filters. Quoting her, we've had a city in the United States of America where the population, which is poor in many ways and majority African American, has been drinking and bathing in lead contaminated water. And the governor of that state acted as though he didn't really care. He had requests for help that he basically stonewalled. Is that what it takes to get?
Yeah.
It's not the suffering of the people, apparently. It's when you get shamed.
Yeah, when you get shamed. I mean, I remember being shamed personally when Katrina happened, and I saw all of those people suffering. I said, where the heck am I living right now? You know, what country? And that's what happened in Michigan with Flint. And the governor there was shamed. You know, people in the state who had access to the government were saying we should be ashamed. And Hillary did put it on a national level, but not before Rachel Maddow did so on MSNBC. I mean, the media was basically, the media should be ashamed. Media wasn't paying any attention to this until Rachel stuck her neck out there again and did some in-depth coverage on it. And I remember the mayor, the new mayor, literally begging for federal help at that time. She's getting it today. That's good. At least she's getting the attention. But sometimes shame is the only tool that poor people have. They don't have the lobbyists on Capitol Hill. They don't have the dollars, the money. But they do have social media, and they have the ability to shame. And I believe, you know, Hillary, blame politics, of course, did that. It was a smart move. Asking him to resign is pure politics. That man's not going anywhere. He's not going to resign because his pure constituents are not going to support his resigning. Now, shame is enough to make him move, to do some things, but he's not going to resign. So calling for his resignation, any smart politician knows that that's a good thing to say. It's a nice thing to say, but he's not resigning.
So then, Benjamin Davis, let's talk about responsibility. If he's not going to take responsibility by resigning, then who is going to take responsibility for the lives of these children in Flint? Some have ingested water that is thousands of times higher in lead content than the government permits. And the levels that people have been consuming and children have been consuming lead are equivalent to what is designated by the EPA as toxic waste. We're talking about, in some cases, 17,000 times the permissible amounts of lead. So you're going to have a whole bunch of kids whose lives are going to be not so much ruined, but certainly diminished.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that the governor of Michigan, Snyder, is more of a Milton Friedman school of economics, which basically means, you know, try to keep the government out of our business as much as possible. But this crisis is turning him into a Keynesian, and in which case he wants the government to come in and provide money to help out.
$96 million he's asking for.
Right. So all of a sudden, you know, he has an economic change of thought here, and he's going to say that's what's going to take care of these children. We're going to beg for money from the government as if we're on state welfare, you know, come take care of our children because we can't take care of our children. And it'll probably work at some point, not right away. I'm sure the Obama administration wants them to sweat through the, at least through the primaries, the general election primaries. They're going to beg, and they will get it. And the kids deserve to get it. They should get it sooner, right away. There should be immediate monitoring of these kids. There should be immediate medical assistance to them in terms of getting them prepped for a future that is questionable at the very least.
There's also apparently a connection to the outbreak of Legionnaire's disease that killed at least 10 people in the Flint area.
Yeah, I saw today where at least a second expert has come forth, and the second expert actually said that it is a direct connection to the water system in Flint. But it hasn't been definitive yet, as you know, but at least one expert believes that those deaths are directly related to the water there.
So, you know, it's pretty clear, as I say, I don't see how the state and the governor can escape responsibility because this decision was literally made by an emergency manager appointed by Governor Rick Snyder, answerable only to Governor Rick Snyder. The local politicians, the council, the mayor, the city elders, you name it, nobody had any say whatsoever. This person had absolute authority. How do we get to situations like that? I mean, it's all tied into this notion of austerity, which they're still trying to push this. You know, even as Obama is creating surpluses now and paying down the debt, They're still out there going on about the deficit. They're Pete Peterson, the Wall Street billionaire, is advertising on television about the deficit and all this stuff. And it's an abstraction. It's just an excuse on the part of Republicans to give tax cuts to the wealthy. But they still somehow, people drink this Kool-Aid of austerity. I mean, how else can you explain, how did this guy get away with this?
Well, you know, cutting budget cuts is a sport. And the GOP is, they're always at their A game when it comes to that sport. And from top to bottom. And in this case, someone at the bottom already knew the rules of the game, knew the rules of the sport. Probably didn't even need anyone to tell them, cut more, cut more. The compassionate conservative that President Bush spoke about one day, that person is somewhere deep in the forest. Not only is he lost, but no one knows where he is.
So then, just in closing, are we back to the current disgraceful and depressing political discourse that has captured the politics of this country at the moment, where you have the most outrageous, racist, poisonous remarks being spewed by leading Republican presidential candidates? Nobody's pulling them over. Not nobody, but they're certainly not being pulled over. The press is certainly not doing much of a job in that regard. Is that in part an explanation for this callousness?
These cats, Donald Trump and their like, they're grasping at straws. They are in the final days of good old days of power. And they see it coming, and they're doing everything they can to hold on to it. And they think it's a zero-sum game. And the rest of us are saying, it's not a zero-sum game, folks. You know, come on over here. We do this together. Everybody shares. But they keep saying it's zero-sum. And if they don't learn now, the lesson is going to come quite soon through social media, through this younger generation, which I'm totally optimistic about. I have no doubt in my mind that what we see now will change amongst young people of different nationalities, different ethnicities, and make their approaches towards making things better. And they will remember this. Woke is what they're talking about. And we're not talking just Caucasians or just African-Americans saying this. They're all saying it.
Well, on a note of optimism, which is rare in my line of work, I'm very grateful to you joining us, Benjamin Davis.
It's my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Benjamin Davis, a professor in digital journalism, broadcast presentation, and writing at California State University, Northridge. He's worked as a reporter for MSNBC.com, ABC News, CBS News, Fox News, and National Public Radio in Washington, D.C. He's the author of the e-book, The Digital Media Pyramid, and has an article at the Huffington Post, Flint and Katrina, Poor People, Poor Treatment, and Water. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm